The temporary regulations, which I mentioned, were a very good sign of this. They allowed the Tsar, for example, to appoint governors of any province with extraordinary, it was called, discretionary power, and gave officials a virtually free hand to imprison and jail and exile citizens without recourse to the law. In fact, there's a telling anecdote at the time describing Alexander III's policies here of reasserting the traditional absolutism of the monarchy. On one occasion, in a private meeting, it should be said, or they would have been in exile if this was a public meeting, Alexander's minister of war was having a chat with a friend of his and said Alexander III reminded him a lot of Peter the Great with his club, going around and using great force to get his way. And his friend said, "No, I think you're only half right there. Alexander was the club without the great Peter. Without, in other words, the vision, the greatness, nothing but stubborn force itself." A somewhat more generous reading was offered by Alexander's Minister of Finance, a man named Sergei Vita, who described Alexander as a mountain of stone, firm and reliable and imposing, needless to say, immovable and unmoving. He was, in other words, a classic Grozny Tsar, all-powerful, mighty. At the same time, he tried to be a Tisheishi Tsar, this also part of the Russian tradition, a pious, loving ruler. Religious faith was central to his understanding of what it meant to be Russian, what it meant to be a Tsar. And he tried to promote this true faith as central to what he thought the state should be doing. More importantly, he believed absolutely and unquestioningly in his divine appointment. His absolute power could be justified in part by the fact that he was divinely chosen and caring for his people. Hence some of his reforms that were meant to improve the life for peasants, the true Russian people. Observers unanimously described Alexander as exuding calm, imperturbable confidence, a mountain of stone, as it were. But there's reason to think that underneath all this, perhaps for Alexander, certainly for many in his circle, there was a great deal of doubt. This wasn't just confident certainty that led to such conservatism. There was also something that might just be described as fear and anxiety and even foreboding about the dangers of change. One sign of this was a rather remarkable turn away from public life in ruling circles. It seemed increasingly that those people with power in Russia showed less and less interest in public civic affairs. They seemed to find these things increasingly distasteful. In court circles, for example, it was noticed an enormous upsurge in the number of lavish balls and receptions and banquets. For example, the Court Journal of 1884 listed 8 huge balls in St. Petersburg alone just in the high season of January and February, and there were many other smaller gatherings. And by the way, it wasn't unusual for one of these great balls, especially if held in the Winter Palace, to be attended by 8,000 highly elite guests. In general, private socializing seemed to increasingly replace concern with public affairs. As one aristocratic woman said at the time, "Society danced more and criticized less. Politics simply ceased to interest the public." The Tsar himself, in fact, seemed to in many ways retreat from public political life whenever possible. Family life began to assume a sort of sacred character for Alexander, a happier realm apart from the state. And in fact, he seemed to prefer more and more time at his country house where he could relax and hunt and go boating and take long walks and chop wood and play with his children. An even more telling indication, though, of the anxieties and the doubts that underlay Alexander III's policy can be found by looking at his closest advisor, a man named Konstantin Pobedonostsev, who lived from 1827 till 1907. In a lot of ways, Pobedonostsev was really probably the most powerful and influential intellectual in Russia during the final decades of Tsarist rule.